friend who also later historians were here, and we spent a lot of time together that weekend walking around and up in the garden, and I was really struggling with chapter three, and I felt like every conversation, all I could do was try to bring it back to chapter three. So every time somebody would raise an unrelated issue, I would say, and that reminds me of chapter three, what can I do with? And by the time I left Claremont, I had figured out the key to chapter three, and I was so happy. So you guys played a big role in the book without even knowing it. So I want to talk about linked labor histories today, but I want to begin by talking about our current crisis that we are facing, and I would say economic and environmental crisis at the beginning of the 21st century. And then I want to think about, try to address how thinking about linked labor histories can help us sort of take apart this crisis, understand it better, and understand potentially some ways of reconceptualizing it and thinking about different kinds of futures. I think our current economic / environmental crisis is based on three wants that we have that are all mutually exclusive and contradictory to each other. And yet we operate as if we wanted all of these three things and we thought somehow that we could achieve all of these three things. And when I say we, I'm not necessarily referring just to us in this room, but I'm referring to policymakers, decision makers, corporations, governments, who are promoting all three of these things as if we could achieve all of them and not noticing how contradictory they are. So the three things, one, we keep being told that the road to recovery is to find good, well-paying jobs and to increase the number of jobs. We need more jobs. And they need to be good jobs. Number two, we are led to believe that we deserve access to cheap and efficient products and services and continually growing and perhaps unlimited amounts of these relatively cheap products and services. And number three, we are led to believe, and probably do believe, that we should strive to achieve some kind of sustainability that will allow the planet to survive our generations and continue to exist and sustain our children and our grandchildren and beyond. Sometimes I notice the contradictions when I look at the front page of the newspaper where there's one set of articles talking about ways that we can create more jobs and consume more products, and another article talking about ways we can reduce our consumption so as to save the planet. And yet the contradiction is never really commented upon. How contradictory are these things? Is there any way to work through and resolve the contradiction and think about a future that is sustainable on all these different sorts of levels? If we want a planet that our children and our grandchildren can continue to live on, it's obvious that we need to consume less. We simply can't continue even the small number of the Earth's inhabitants who consume as much as those of us in this room do, and I would put us amongst the highest consumers on the Earth if you just look statistically speaking. The United States, for example, has about 4% of the world's population, consumes between 25 and 50% of the world's resources, depending on which resources you're talking about. So we're all guilty here in this room, no matter how little we consume. So we need to consume less. What about our access to a lot of cheap products and services? Is there a way to achieve that? I think we need to recognize that cheap products and services come from exploited workers. And if our products and services are cheap, it's because somebody is living at a standard of living much lower than our own and doing the work to provide us with those products and services. We can only get products and services cheaply if there's somebody poor enough who's willing to work for the low wages that it takes to produce those products and services cheaply. But the third one, I think, is the most complicated one of all. The first one, now I'm going backwards, so it becomes the third one. Our desire for more jobs and better jobs. And that's the one I want to spend a little bit more time thinking about. And again, I'll come back to all three of them and the contradictions are not among them. I think we need to problematize the issue of jobs and why people work, how work fits into the bigger picture, jobs fit into the bigger picture, and that's something that I really try to do in the book. To begin with, I think we should remember that labor history, if we look at a long history of labor history, we see some very big transformations going on at different times, and that what we think of as jobs today is something rather historically new. Until about 1800, depending on where in the world you're looking, sometimes late in the 1800s, sometimes well into the 20th century, jobs as we understand them today didn't really exist. Most people worked for themselves, and the only way to mobilize labor on a large scale to work in the long term for somebody else was through force, various forms of slavery, or labor taxation, labor drafts of different sorts. Some people worked in a temporary basis as an apprentice for somebody else, reformulate, to go back a few will be worth more to them because they come from a poorer region and they intend to either send the money back to their poorer homeland or to return to their poorer homeland with the money. So they're willing to come to the wealthier region and work for wages that are not living wages in the wealthier region, but are in the poorer region. One reason that these wages paid in the wealthier region can purchase more in the poorer region, and the workers can be supplied apparently more cheaply in the wealthier region, is that in the poorer region, much of the reproduction of the labor force comes from the subsistence economy. People are still farming, they're still producing their own food, their own goods, they're raising their children on their own production, and then they're sending those children off to work on a temporary basis for very low wages, wages that are not capable of sustaining reproduction without the interaction with the subsistence sector. So it's the exploitation not only of the individual worker, but of the subsistence sector as a whole that's producing a continual stream of workers to then be sent and work in the industrial economy. This is a factor not only at the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, but continues to be a factor today. So migration is one way, and I'll talk more about these on the specifics. The second way that capital has been able to benefit from regional inequalities is through capital flight. That is moving production from a wealthier region to a poorer region. So if workers are able to better their conditions, if governments are able to create better conditions for workers in one region, and the standard of living rises in that region as a consequence, a factory then doesn't want to have to pay all of those benefits and wages and abide by environmental protection and health and safety legislation. They can move to the poorer region, where they can go back to sweatshop types of conditions. We certainly see this, have both of these phenomena happening today, but I argue that they've happened throughout the history of industrial labor. So number one is migration, number two is capital flight. Once again, number three is the most complicated. Number three is what I call labor management collaboration. That is, workers achieved otherwise? The workers, when they left the subsistence economy, still had to subsist. They still had to eat. And I look, in addition to the textile industry, I look to the banana industry, which also started in New England around the same time that the textile industry started. It was a Boston-based firm, the United Fruit Company. And they used precisely the same strategies. They considered banana an industrial fruit. And they went into potential banana-producing regions, which were in Central America and Colombia. And they immediately began a policy of multiple production sites so that they could play them off against each other, and bringing in migrant workers from different regions to work in the banana industry. And the people who went to work in both of these industries went with precisely the same intentions, which was they didn't want to be permanent workers. They didn't want good jobs for their entire lives. They wanted to work to achieve certain economic goals in order to return to the subsistence economy. Just to read you a quote from an early company biography at the beginning of the 20th century. Boston and its factory suburbs were growing. Factory workers were eager buyers of bananas as long as the fruit was cheap. Cheap product, very important. Any enterprise or any statesmanship which increases the productivity of these tropical sections adds directly to the assets and welfare of the people of the United States. This is an official company biography. And it brings out yet another way that regional integration is important, that is, the workers in the factories in Boston depended on cheap produce brought in from Central America. That is, they depended on a colonial relationship. Their access to cheap products while they were in the workforce depended on some people being even poorer than them, working for even lower wages than them, and providing them with the food they needed to eat in order to work in the textile factories, in order to go home and buy their land in New Hampshire or in southern Italy or wherever they intended to go back home. So, the banana planters are using the multiple sites of production, capital flight and migrant labor strategies. Textile factories are using those strategies, and they're integrated with each other as they're using those strategies. It's not long, I'll get to that in just a minute. So the workers, as you can see in the quote from the company biography, are being encouraged to think of themselves as sharing an interest with the employers and a national interest in maintaining these colonies for their cheap products. Because that's how the United States can industrialize. It's a national interest defined, it adds to the assets and welfare of the people of the United States. So here's where we get into a little bit of the labor management collaboration as well. That is, the workers are encouraged to think of themselves, and they are given explicit advantages for being part of the United States and accepting and promoting U.S. imperialism in Central America. And we see this as the AFL-CIO begins to articulate foreign policy also around the beginning of the 20th century, and it's very much interests lie with the interests of the U.S. government in expanding U.S. power abroad, because abroad being in Latin America at the beginning of the 20th century, because that's a way we can increase the standard of living of the working class of the United States by enlarging their access to cheap products. I'm talking for the last 2 hours. Okay, so in both the banana region and the textile region, in Boston and in northern Colombia, as workers become more So the company resorts to looking for new sources of migrant labor, and they resort to using their multiple sites of production for capital flight. If there's a strike in one factory, they'll just transfer production to another factory. If the workers are too demanding and hungry in one place, or if the government starts to implement minimum wages that they feel are too high from the company's perspective, they can close the factory completely. And the first wave of factory closures in New England was textile factories in the 1920s. Almost all of the cotton textile factories shut down in the 1920s to move to the South. And they very clearly articulated the reasons. There's no unions in the South, there's no taxes, there's no environmental regulations. Local governments in the South were creating industrial recruitment packages where they would promise free, they would build railways, they would train workers, they put together these incentive packages for industries to try to lure them down. Spartanburg County, South Carolina, published a poster that said, "Spartanburg County, the Lowell of the South," with a picture of their textile factories. So they use both of those strategies, but they also use those strategies to push for labor management collaboration. That is, they told their workers, cooperate, or we'll leave, cooperate, or you'll be replaced. And they told governments the same thing, cooperate, or we'll leave. Meanwhile, the workers gradually were both buying into the colonial model in which they survived on cheap products from the tropical world, the colonial world, rather than their home subsistence economy, especially after World War I, which cut off the option for many European immigrants to return home. Their ties to the subsistence economy were broken. Becoming more and more dependent on the jobs and on the cheap products that were being brought in because of this sort of national policy, workers are becoming more and more prone to, instead of, I mean, there's really two union movements in the first half of the 20th century in the United States. There's a radical union movement, which is fighting very hard for better conditions, with the idea that, as stated by one of the strike leaders in the 1933 strike in Salem, a victory in this plant is a victory for textile workers everywhere. That is, if we raise the floor here, that's going to help workers everywhere improve their conditions. Versus the attitude of the United Textile Workers, AFL-CIO, during the Salem strike, which was, we have to cooperate with management, otherwise they're going to go to South Carolina, just like all of the other cotton textile factories in the area. So the AFL-CIO policy, although the 1933 strike was victorious in the Salem mill, overall the AFL-CIO opted for the labor management collaboration slash colonial model of trying to improve workers' rights in the United States. And you may hear some echoes here of this idea that jobs are the greatest good and companies are doing us a favor by giving us jobs. Let me read you one of my favorite quotes from the book, because it brings all these different places and moments together. This comes from the conclusion. I say, the Salem Evening News, that's Salem, Massachusetts, which is where I live now and where the 1933 strike took place, reminded striking mill workers in 1933 that, quote, in these days of such widespread unemployment, persons with a job are mighty lucky and should appreciate the fact. Just parenthetically here, from the U.S. South, the textile industry moved to Puerto Rico, to Mexico, and to Colombia. We want access to lots of cheap products and services, and we want a planet that our children and grandchildren can still live on. I think the planet is non-negotiable. That is, there's no way around it. We really want a planet that our children and grandchildren can live on, and the only way that we can achieve this is by lowering consumption. How we can lower consumption, I think, brings us to the second point, access to lots of cheap products and services. Certainly, we have been trained and schooled in every aspect of our lives to think that economic growth is the answer to economic problems. Economic growth is the answer to poverty, it's the answer to unemployment, it's the answer to lack of good jobs, it's the answer to the lack of the necessities of life, that economic growth is the only solution out there, and that access to cheap products and services is necessary for our survival, and just like the bananas and coffee that the 19th century textile workers were surviving on, is the reason that we do what we do is to have access to cheap products and services. There's very few economists or politicians who question this idea of economic growth. And yet there are some, and I think it's really worth paying attention to what they're saying. A small group of economists based mostly in Europe is promoting the idea of degrowth. And degrowth goes beyond just we have to consume less so that the planet can survive. Degrowth is a much more developed set of ideas about what kind of global economy can we really strive for. Just a couple of the things about degrowth that I'd ask you to think about. Degrowth points out that consumption is very poorly distributed around the world, and that the first world, and particularly the United States, consume far more than our share of the resources, and that degrowth is not to apply equally to everybody, but should apply first to the first world, and first of all to the United States. That is, degrowth has to be coupled with redistribution of resources. We don't want to say to poor people in poor countries, well, they'll never get to consume everything. If we could de-link the social safety network from the job, many of us might be liberated to think about jobs in very different ways. That is, if we could make socialize the social safety network, if we, for example, could create a real system of national health insurance, where your access to health insurance was not dependent on your job. I know many people who would love to work half-time if they didn't have to work full-time to get health benefits. So I think the idea of socializing the safety network instead of making that safety network dependent on jobs is one step that we could take to rethink what we mean by jobs and good jobs. At the same time, this is my last point, I think we need to put inequalities at the center of our analysis and our questioning of what we want to do about our economic system and about capitalism. It's inequalities that have global inequalities and local inequalities, regional inequalities that have allowed for capital flight, migration, and labor management collaboration that have led us to this position that any job is a good job and we need more jobs because jobs are what we need. That have led us to the race to the bottom where different regions, different countries, different people are competing with each other to offer better conditions to companies, that is, worse conditions to workers and people in order to attract the industries there. And it's inequalities that have played an important role in the environmental destruction, because we see this playing out in every state of the United States right now, that there's strong arguments against environmental regulation of industry because the industry will go somewhere else if we put too many restrictions on it. So my final words in terms of how do we want to rethink the future we want to have would be that I think we need to place